Here's a trivia question for you. How many know that a satellite was once shot down by a pilot in an F-15? Does anybody know that? It actually happened. This is not fiction. And tonight we're very pleased to have the gentleman who was the pilot in command of that flight with us. Major General Doug Pearson Jr. was that pilot, and General Pearson is currently commander of the Air Force Flight Test Center at Edwards Air Force Base. Aside from that historic flight in the 80s, his 40-year career has allowed him to fly a variety of aircraft from the F-4 Phantom to the FA-22. And he'll talk tonight about that historic flight and some of the new developments that are coming up with the F-35. We are very pleased to have him with us tonight. Please join me in welcoming Major General Doug Pearson.
Well, thank you very much. Awesome to be here, and the film we just watched was really, really impressive, and brought back lots of memories. My first memories of flying came very early in life, and I was addicted, like many of you, to flying, and flying was certainly my passion. So I was able to live my dream, much like in the movies, and I went for my first flight in a 1946 Stinson off of a grass strip in a little place called Oil City, Louisiana. And as soon as I got airborne, I knew flying was for me, and I pursued it ever since and continue to fly at any opportunity I can. So I pumped gas and cut grass and did whatever else I could do to earn enough money to get my pilot's license while I was going to Texas A&M. And wanted to join the Air Force. I knew I wanted to be a fighter pilot, and I was fortunate enough to be able to do that. So I've had a blessed life. I've got to do a lot of things, most of them in the air, and I'll tell you about a couple of them tonight and take questions if there's time later. But just briefly, in my career, mostly was fighters, but it was all about experimental work from the very beginning at A&M. Several of us got into the experimental business with a T-34 and a PA-18 and the number one, number two Grumman AgCats that we put back and made fly. And later on, we went from there into the military, and we went off and did great and wonderful things, or at least they were exciting things, from combat to flight test. It was a blessing. So I would encourage all of you to encourage people of all ages to pursue their dreams. If you can dream it, you can do it. And if you want to fly, you can. There's always a way, and there's a will. So with that, I'll go a little briefly, but I got asked to tell a little bit about the ASAT story. And the most common questions I get was, why did you shoot down a satellite? And of course, the easy one to answer was, it intentional? And the answer to that was yes, it was intentional. And to really appreciate the story, you have to understand the setting of what was going on in the world events in the mid-1980s. The actual shootdown took many years to accomplish, but it actually happened on Friday the 13th, September the 13th, 1985. So in about 2 months, it'll be 25 years ago. But at the early 80s, many of you will recall the Reagan buildup years, Star Wars, the Cold War, and all those other terms that kind of captured the imagination and the environment the world was in. The former Soviet Union was absolutely convinced that the United States of America was prepared and preparing to preemptively strike the friends and the Soviet Union themselves. So they were trying to defend themselves from their point of view. So they wanted to keep up with the U.S. military forces. So where in the world the U.S. military forces were drove Soviet policy. So they needed to keep up. They developed a very impressive capability of launching reconnaissance satellites very quickly, and they could take film and they would take pictures of U.S. forces around the world. The most dynamic forces were the carrier battle groups. An awesome carrier battle group in the Pacific or in the Atlantic could maneuver and show up over the horizon and intimidate or conduct combat operations when necessary in a relatively short notice. So the Soviets needed to keep up with them. Thus, the reconnaissance satellites, they could do that from space. So we needed the way to take out those reconnaissance satellites as fast as they can put them up. We needed to knock them down so that we could give the carrier battle group about 24 hours to maneuver and show up where he needed to show up and do what he needed to do. So that was the setting. And it was very difficult to do. The Soviets had been trying to do it for many years, and the U.S. had been trying to do it for many years. There were land-based concepts, and there were airborne concepts. The land-based concept from a rocket had some drawbacks. Mainly, it had a relatively limited cross-track. The satellite kind of had to be coming over you to get a good shot, meaning you had to have lots of sights. If you had an airborne capability, you could send the airplane to wherever it needed to be underneath the satellite and take your shot. So that was a concept we were working on and tried to perfect and eventually did. Like I say, it was a multi-year effort. The film you just saw, Flight Over the Rockies, is interesting because the connection with the Rockies and the ASAT program is at the Cheyenne Mountain complex. There at Space Command is where the mission was planned and where it was actually executed from, and all the space surveillance, as you probably know, feeds into Cheyenne Mountain. So it's interesting, the connection between the film we just saw. And from there, we ran the airplane side of the program from Edwards Air Force Base. We had a couple of F-15s that had been slightly modified, but not much, to provide basically the first stage to carry a purpose-built ASAT missile that was about 13 feet long and weighed about 3,000 pounds. It was a two-stage rocket motor. It had a SRAM rocket motor for the first stage and an all-tier rocket motor for the upper stage. And then the device that actually went into space and intercepted the satellite and hit it and killed it was called a miniature vehicle. It was about 12 inches or so in diameter and about 13 inches long. No moving parts. State of the art for mid-1980s. It was all digital and it was all solid state. So the key component in it was an IR seeker that could detect a cigarette at a very, very long range. And it had to be able to get out of the atmosphere and look and find the heat generated by this small satellite maybe a couple thousand miles away. So that's what we had, that's what we tried to do. It was a lot of awfully hard work went into it in integrating space-based and space-rated systems onto man-rated airplanes and then able to fly them out of the desert. We had our own clean tent where we built up the missile, and it was space-rated. So that it would perform in space, and in fact it did. There are a lot more elements of it, but I'll just tell you, on show day, we had tried multiple attempts before. There had been two rockets launched prior to the intercept. The program was in jeopardy of being canceled because of all the political aspects. You know, politics seems to get into everything, but it was not, and we had decided, instead of going for all of the launches and the build-up to the kind of the final exam, the intercept mission, as a third mission came around, we decided to go for the intercept, and we got presidential authority to do that. There was a ban on testing in space, so it took President Reagan's personal signature and President Reagan's personal notification to Congress 15 days prior to the mission. To give us the authority to go execute this mission. All that came together, not without a lot of issues, but it did. And on Friday the 13th, I took off out of Edwards in an F-15 with an F-15 Chase, and we flew about 200 miles out over the Pacific. The satellite was actually over Hawaii at the time of launch. The mission profile was about 30,000 feet, accelerate the F-15 in full power to about Mach 1.3, and then execute a 4G pull-up to a 60-degree climb angle, plus or minus about a degree, and going through 35,000 feet at 0.96 Mach, launch the missile. And the missile ejected from the aircraft after better part of a second would ignite and launch and go into space. And as you might imagine, that was a very wild ride. So on that day, it was just afternoon, about 12:44 and 36 seconds afternoon, it went up and intercepted the target. The satellite was just under 300 miles on orbit. It was a prior research satellite that had been on orbit about 6 years, had been planned to last about 3 years, P-78-1, and it was still functioning. So it was fairly representative of the kinds of targets we were going after. But we didn't tell anybody we were going to do that because at the time, as you would imagine, it was fairly classified. So when it went offline, we had a number of people using the research from that satellite that were rather surprised, but they understood a little later on. The Soviets gave us great credit for what actually happened, probably more credit than we deserved. We made it look relatively easy, and it was extraordinarily difficult. We let them believe that we had a large number of missiles ready to go that exceeded the number of satellites they had ready to go. And something transferred at the very high levels between our State Department and our president and the Soviet Union. And over the course of the next 9 months, we were never allowed to intercept another target. We did launch another two more missiles, but we were never able to intercept another target. And about a year later, the program was put in kind of cold storage, and the missiles we had were stored. And we eventually, about a year after that, the program was actually canceled. So that's kind of what happened. There's a lot more to it, but it would take a lot more time to tell that. But I do want to mention one other thing, and it all comes back to EAA and the dream of flight and the pursuit of flight and the pursuit of your dreams. But I mentioned earlier the intercept mission, the actual ASAT intercept where we shot down a satellite, was the third mission. We had two prior missiles launched. The first was a ballistic launch, and then the second was a point in space where we wanted to make sure the sensor would work, and we launched it, and we targeted a star. We did not hit the star, but it did go toward the star and showed us what we needed to do. But the first missile was shot by a guy that was the commander of the organization at the time. And it just so happens that guy and I had worked at Texas A&M at the research center there on the experimental aircraft, the Grumman AgCat and the T-34. And by chance tonight, when I was standing in the back room, Major Phil Fairburn walked in and said, "Is this the same Aggie?" And Phil Fairburn is in the audience tonight. Phil, where are you? I can't see you for all the lights. Where he is, over here. Phil Fairburn. As a veteran, a great test pilot, and a great friend, and another great American who followed his dreams, and he's a great member of VAA, and he's here for the air show. So Phil, thanks for leading the way with the ASAT program and launching the first missile that showed the rest of us how to do it. So awesome, Phil, thanks for being here. All right, well, the next thing I want to do is give you a little bit of an update on the F-35 program. I retired from the United States Air Force after 34 years and flying fighters and doing other experimental things. I did a lot of cruise missile work. I did a lot of fighter work. I did F-5s, T-38s, F-15s, F-20, some helicopters. Got to fly C-17s and about 100 other airplanes. So, like I say, I've been real blessed to do a lot of different things. And after I retired, or actually right before I retired, my last stint as a commander of the Air Force Flight Test Center, the F-22 program, the Raptor, which many of you have seen and has graced these airspaces here, was a little bit in trouble, and the program was not performing real well. So the Chief of Staff of the United States Air Force and the Secretary of the United States Air Force visited me at Edwards one day, which actually was the first time the chief and secretary had been at Edwards at the same time, but they were there, and wanted to know what was going on. As you might imagine, it was not really a very pleasant conversation. When you have a four-star and his boss converging on you and trying to ask for explanations, it's hot tonight, but it was really hot that day. Anyway, long story short, they gave me all the authority and responsibility for executing the FA-22 program from the government side. And over the next 3 years, we were able to turn around the program with a lot of help from people all over the world, really, and deliver the FA-22, which is now in lethal combat operations around the world as needed, or standing ready to do that. It's a great airplane, and going from there. So after I retired, I never thought Lockheed Martin would want to talk to me, but they did. And 5 years ago, I took a position with Lockheed Martin to help them exercise the F-35 flight test program. So I've been the vice president for F-35 test and verification for the last 5 years. Last week, I announced my retirement, my second retirement, from Lockheed Martin. My wife said I flunked the first retirement, so I'm going to try again. And I've given them 6 months' notice. I'm going to leave the program next February. So hopefully I can spend more time with some of these great organizations like EAA and Young Eagles and some others. So I'm looking forward to that time. But tonight I'll offer you, as taxpayers and interested in aviation, a little update on the F-35 program. It's still new, if you will, but this is what we have today. So if you'll bring up these charts and go to the next one. I have two other F-35s out at Edwards Air Force Base, AF-1 and AF-2. And by the time I retire next February, I would expect to have six more delivered to the Air Force Flight Test Center at Edwards and to Pax River. So our flight test program is 12 fighters. We have it's a trivariant. We have three different airplanes, variants of airplanes to test, one for the Air Force, one for the Marine Corps, and one for the United States Navy. I'll tell you a little bit more of those that go along. I'm going to probably tell you a little bit more about the program than you want to know, but as taxpayers and this early in the program, it may be important you know why do we need the F-35 and why do we need a stealthy airplane and some of those. So if you go to the next chart, here's one of the many reasons. That's not the next chart I thought I'd get, but that is the next chart. I was going to further tell you that we build the airplane in a partnership of BAE out of the UK, Northrop Grumman out of Los Angeles, El Segundo, and Lockheed Martin in Fort Worth, Texas. We build in Fort Worth the forward section and the wings. BAE builds the aft section, and Northrop Grumman builds the center section with the weapon bays. All of those major assemblies come to Fort Worth, and they're assembled there. So if you're interested in doing home built, I've included some stuff in here to show you how we build the F-35, and later on I've actually got a little video of how we build it. So this isn't all about pilots, but if you are a pilot and you're interested in flying, I've got another video that shows you some of the early flight tests that we've conducted up through the first vertical landing on the F-35B. So next chart. I'll go through these pretty quickly, but here is why we need F-35s, and here's why America and her allies need to recapitalize our fighter force. If you have a vested interest in freedom, and because you're here, I suspect you do, it's not free. We have to keep the fight up, we have to keep the vigilance, we have to protect our interests, so we need a valid, legitimate, credible military force. That carrier battle group that I talked about protecting before needs to be at will to maneuver around the world's ocean, to show up on the horizon that needs to show up, to make people behave around the world. That's very important. We need the F-35 on board, the long deck carriers and the short deck carriers, to be able to go in long range under stealthy conditions to any defensive system that our enemies would choose to put up and be successful, and then come home with your sons and your daughters and my son and my daughter. That's very important to me. So I won't belabor this, but you can see the big mountain there of what we used to have and where we are today with the relatively flat, low forces, and the F-35 is that little green hump over there on the right. So this is a serious issue, and we should not let our politicians trade away our military forces for other programs. Next chart. Thank you. Call your politicians and let them know if you believe in that. And here's why they should believe in it. This is probably the best deal going in modern history about the capabilities of fighter airplanes in today. This is a combination of state-of-the-art technologies and legacy technologies, and it's built literally around the world. We build the parts for this airplane in 18 different time zones around the world. And I'll show you another chart in a minute that gives all that. If you're really interested, you can get it very specifically and study it. But almost all of the countries in the free world contribute. And from a value proposition, we compete all of these individual subassemblies and parts, and the people, the companies, the businesses, the small businesses that can produce the part at the best value gets the contract. It's not the good old boy, you scratch my back and I'll scratch your back. You buy an airplane and we'll give you more parts. It doesn't work that way. It's the best value, it's very competitive, and it will be that way over the next 40 years as we build this airplane for at least 30 to 40 years. So